The Guardian. Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Looks like Wayne might be needing that caravan and pot noodle after all. Yes, it's International Week, with many a footballer leaving others in the club back home and running off and scoring. And we bring you a comprehensive roundup of all the top international action, and Scotland too, with thrilling news and reviews. Top of the bill, England 4, Bulgaria 0, a brilliant start for under Farcapello. But with Switzerland next on Tuesday in Basel, will we have to dust off our Basel faulty headlines? Elsewhere, new look Italy finds success, and there's big wins for Holland and Spain. But oh no, more problems for Portugal and France too, beaten at home by Belarus. There's Ewan Murray on the line to talk Scottish football, post non-league day, big Jed to Villa, and more in Football Weekly. Hello everyone, on board today, an eclectic mix of podcasting talent. Barney Roney.
Hi James.
Hi Barney. Paolo Bandini.
Hello. Hi James.
Yeah, etc. And Simon Burnton, who brought cake. Thanks Simon.
It was a pleasure.
It was. It's quite a kind of test match special feel now, because you've got a big Tupperware box there with one or two birthday parties. Whose birthday party was it?
It was my daughter Talia's third birthday party yesterday, so leftovers for everyone.
All right.
Except for anyone listening, no leftovers for you.
Right. Big shout out to Talia then.
Yeah.
England then. Barney Roney, you spent Friday evening enjoying the spectacle from Wembley. Tell us more.
I really enjoyed it, actually. I thought it was a nice light performance after the World Cup. I thought England played very well, even though obviously the last three goals came against a team who seemed to have basically given up. But I thought there was a lot of encouragement. I thought we had a goalkeeper who was in form. The defence looked really good. I thought I thought all three centre backs played really well. I mean, before the World Cup, I wrote a piece suggesting that either Jagielka or Cahill should have been drafted in when Ferdinand was injured, because they're that more mobile, more athletic defender. And when you don't play a midfield shield, you need someone who can run a bit to fill the gaps. And instead, we went with two stopper types, and it obviously didn't work very well. But Jagielka was great. I think Cahill's a very good defender, and they just lack a bit of experience.
Joe Hart.
He made two saves. One of them was kind of straight at him. It was one of those blocks, but he did well to get it away. And then he made one where he made himself big and blocked the ball very well. Mm. I mean, he's really
in not in that way, not in an Ashley Young sense.
He also made one fantastic stop from Glenn Johnson.
Yeah. No, he's really in form. I mean, maybe he's the answer. Who knows? I get really wary of building up goalkeepers, because then it all goes wrong.
No, but he's the real deal, isn't he?
Today, suggesting that he's going to break Peter Shilton's record for England caps.
And at least.
And this is the kind of reaction that has my head in my hands.
But, Nick Greaves saying, nice to see Joe Hart having a laugh with Glenn Johnson as they came off, because he did have a big grin on his face. That was almost a clang. It was nice to see somebody with that kind of youthful enjoyment of the game.
And I think the thing you have to bear in mind is that Joe Hart is just in a very good moment of form. And the only shame, I would say, and of course, you know, you never know what he would have done in the World Cup, is I do think he was in a good moment of form at the end of last season, and he's carried it over to this season. And you think, well, maybe it would have been nice to have him in goal this summer. It didn't happen then, obviously, but right now he's really enjoying his football. And you can see it after the game, Man City-Tottenham game, at the beginning of the season as well. He had a fantastic game that day, came off with a big grin on his face, and why shouldn't he? He's playing very well.
You do speak quickly, don't you, Paolo?
Sorry.
Sorry. A brilliant start then, Barney. What's going to go wrong this time then?
I mean, what might go wrong is we might play a team who are slightly better than Bulgaria and are more interested in closing England down and really coming to fight.
Is that team Switzerland?
No, I don't think it necessarily is. They can obviously defend better than Bulgaria can. They beat Spain at the World Cup. But England we've got a good attacking partnership now. I thought that was very good, the Defoe-Rooney partnership, our best finisher and our best creator. And Rooney was played in a very sensible position, not the free role, which he interprets as running around everywhere. He was given a blinkered free role. I want you to play just behind the front striker. It's not, free role doesn't mean literally free, which seems to be the way he plays it. But Capello played him in the same way he played against Croatia away, where he's very disciplined in that hole.
Sorry, it's just
we've
the effort.
Problems with Rooney,
Wayne
and Hole
Rooney in the hole.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Now, Switzerland, eh? Let's find out more about this exciting Swiss team that will be providing the next obstacle for Capello's England reboot. Let's dial up now the man web fans everywhere know as Swiss Rambler. By day known as Kieran O'Connor in Zurich. Hello, Kieran.
Hello, James.
Hi, Kieran. We're just sat here in the pod, orbiting high above the globe, etc., discussing the fact that Switzerland are up next for England. They beat the world champions in South Africa. Surely they could do the same to England.
Well, the Swiss almost work on the opposite principle to England, so they're normally fairly pessimistic before any big game, and they still have a huge amount of respect for the English team, notwithstanding some of the off-the-pitch revelations, which have kept the Swiss amused for the last couple of weeks. But I think their expectation is that they will probably get beaten. Hitzfeldt, the Swiss manager, has said that England are clear favourites for the group and everyone else is really playing for second place.
The mood there is not desperately positive. Is that also because of the 0-0 they had with Australia on Friday?
Yeah, and that 0-0 is symptomatic of the Swiss problem, which is scoring goals. They've only scored four times in their last 10 games, and the last time they scored more than one goal was against mighty Luxembourg. So this is a huge problem for them. Their top scorer is the captain, Alex Frey, who's got 40 goals, but he hasn't scored for the national team for a year. And he was actually booed and whistled on Friday night in the match against Australia. The other striker that will probably play tomorrow night is Eren Derdiok. And you might remember that he scored the Swiss goal against England at Wembley, which I think I'm right in saying was Capello's first game as manager. But he hasn't done a great deal since for the national team.
A bit like Capello, some would say. Paolo.
Hi, Kieran. It's Paolo here. I was just wondering, I mean, it seems like this is something for Switzerland that goes back a number of years, even to the last World Cup. I mean, is it systemic or is it just that there's not strikers in the country who are up to the job?
It's a little bit of a reflection of the national character. I mean, I don't necessarily want to drop into stereotypes, but the Swiss team's strength is the collective, very disciplined, organised, hard-working, which reflects the people. I think it's going to change over time because the younger Swiss players that are beginning to be introduced into the team are much more attacking and aggressive. Switzerland won the under-17 World Cup to huge disbelief last November, beating the host nation Nigeria in the final. And that team was extremely positive, scored loads of goals, beat the likes of sort of Italy and Brazil en route. But it's obviously far too early for tomorrow's match.
Sadly. I presume that whole young boys Spurs thing is kind of irrelevant to the England-Switzerland game.
Well, yes and no. But there are actually five players from young boys in the Swiss squad, though I don't expect many of them to start. David Degen, the twin brother of Philippe Degen, the former Liverpool player, is a possibility on the wing. The rest probably not. Where I think there might be some relevance is that Swiss teams normally start quite quick in a game, as young boys did against Spurs. So I think England might be a little bit surprised by the atmosphere tomorrow. I'm expecting quite a warm reception, not sort of Galatasaray level, but Basel is a fairly intimidating stadium. And I'm expecting a quick start, but I'm also expecting the Swiss team to tire.
Simon here. Is Enfield-born Tottenham fan Scott Sutter going to make a second appearance for the national team?
I'd be very surprised. He made his debut Friday night, came on for the second half against Australia. But the regular right-back is a guy called Stefan Ligsteiner, who played in the World Cup. And I anticipate that the whole of the defence will be the one that ended up the World Cup for Switzerland, including the goalkeeper, who's probably Switzerland's best player in my books, Diego Benaglio. There is a doubt about him because his wife is due to give birth the day after the match.
So he's probably out shagging someone, is he?
Well, he's already said that if that happens, he's going to be at her side, in which case the deputy keeper will have to play.
All right, it's not the only absence. Valérien Bérami's out, Hakan Yakin as well. Not all bad news, though, because Philip Senderos is also unavailable. So there you go. What would you make? A quick prediction then, Kieran?
I would expect England to win, but I don't think it'll necessarily be as comfortable as they might think. A draw is not out of the question.
Football Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
Kieran O'Connor, who is Swiss Ramble, who you can find on Twitter and on his own special blogspot. Loads of interesting things there. Barney?
I'm just going to add that I thought it was a really interesting matchup between Hitzfeld and Capello, these two super managers of the 2000s and the 90s, are both knocking on a bit in international football now. And, yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, their records are second to none.
Yeah, indeed so. Lots of people with other points about England. The real Wiki Man says, surely tonight, referring to Friday, absolute proof, Lampard is the problem. Without him, everything else fits better. Is that fair, do you think, Barney?
I think Lampard and Gerrard together is the problem. Whenever one of them plays with a more defensive player, England play better.
All right. Super injunction, Barney.
Yeah, they're popular, aren't they?
They are popular. That's an injunction on the injunction. Mm. Injunction to stop you talking about a story. Super injunction to stop you talking about the fact that you're not allowed to talk about a story. Rooney, who had a super injunction, which is why this story hadn't come to light until now.
Rooney's story now having broken. I mean, I support fully the super injunction.
You do?
Yeah, I don't see why we're reading about this. Don't see what it's got to do with the public interest at all. It just adds to the sum of human misery. I mean, do we really need to read about anything other than what Wayne Rooney does with the football? I really don't get it. I could see with the John Terry one, possibly you could claim that was in the public interest because Wainbridge then didn't go to the World Cup.
Yeah.
But this is a problem with a man and his wife. I don't see what it's got anything to do with anything. And I think the News of the World should be slightly ashamed of itself for publishing this rubbish.
Yeah,
it's one of those things that makes me a bit, well, it makes me very tired of football, that the amount of questionable nonsense that's published and talked about in between matches. Wayne Rooney's a lovely player and I love watching him play, but after the final whistle goes and from that moment until the start of the next match, I don't give a damn.
Right, okay. The football angle that's been touted by papers, who possibly quite fancy talking about it anyway, was that maybe this is what has been behind his goal drought.
Yes, and the problem is that people are willing to publish these kind of stories, and that's obviously very stressful. I mean, he's been worried about the News of the World publishing a tawdry story about his private life, so maybe the News of the World shouldn't publish tawdry stories about his private
life. His association with this person wasn't behind his goal drought. He was scoring very well in all senses at that time. It was just the threat of publication.
So right.
It's the papers themselves that are responsible, if anyone is, for his failings at the World Cup, and not Wayne Rooney or his liaisons with whoever he's liaising with.
Equally, the thing about my 14-year-old son adores Wayne Rooney, now he's got to read about this. Well, 14-year-olds will always adore and idolise footballers. It's all the more reason not to publish these kind of stories, because I just don't see who it benefits.
Well, I'm not sure if the moral fault is necessarily the papers or the person who has let that 14-year-old down. All right, well, let's move on then from naughty Wayne. Also in England's group, Wales, who had their sixth defeat in nine. I was quite optimistic about their chances away against the admittedly tough Montenegro, but they lost 1-0. Brilliant goal from Roma's Mirko Vucinic, who skipped merrily past James Collins there and unleashed a thunderbolt-ish.
Yeah, lovely goal.
Mm.
I didn't see this game, so I was just wondering if someone did, they could tell me. I mean, how are Wales using Gareth Bale? Because obviously this season he's been fantastic on the left wing for Tottenham. I actually think he's been their best player so far this season. And I'm wondering if they're still using him at left back for Wales or if they've moved him up the pitch as well.
Well, he seemed to be playing in an advanced position when I saw. I mean, he's great. I mean, he's just a brilliant player, isn't he? He's so fast and strong. And he looks like the best left-sided player around at the moment. He played very well for Wales. And they did have chances. Bellamy missed a couple. The pitch was quite difficult. It's very sad for Wales. They have a shallow talent pool and two of their best players are injured and it's very difficult for them. It should be a new era for them. There is a lot of talent out there. But
Regarding Gareth Bale, it'll be interesting to see if the arrival of Van der Vaart at Tottenham means that he gets played at left-back more than he has been.
Mm. John Toshak seems he'll be vacating the post of Wales manager after their next two qualifiers in October. There's been talk, Simon, of Ryan Giggs taking over.
Yeah, I from all that I can tell, talk is exactly what it is at the moment. And I think the consensus is that he would be extremely unwilling to give up his playing career at this point.
And he won't do it for friendlies as well, just for the big games.
And that Chris Coleman might be a better bet.
No. Oh. All right, then. He was always so keen to turn up for matches. I just thought he'd be, you know, leaping at the chance. Mm. All right, that is part one. In part two, we ramp up the tension and excitement still further as we turn our attention to other European qualifiers, including the French. Part two, then. France. Now, we're going to have a proper chat about the French after their next game, which is away in Sarajevo to Bosnia and Herzegovina. But in the meantime, as you probably know, they've lost their fourth game in a row, despite the arrival of Laurent Blanc. It's still a disaster with Les Bleus. In Paris, they went down 1-0 to Belarus. And the game in Sarajevo, they're going to be without forwards Guillaume Auroux, Loïc Rémy and Luis Sahar, which means they've called up Olympic Lyonnais forward Jimmy Briand. You heard of this man before? He's an Olympic Lyonnais forward. Have you heard of Jimmy Briand?
Jimmy Briand.
I've heard of Chateaubriand. Is that where...
Probably where he lives. I don't know. There. Sounds fantastic. We'll hear more about all of that on Thursday. Bosnia-Herzegovina, as you probably know, also up-to-date listeners that you are, won 3-0 against Luxembourg on Friday. Other French news, though. Gerard Houllier, technical director for the French Federation, to Aston Villa. What's the latest on this extraordinary story?
Well, apparently there's going to be an announcement today, and it may well be that he is the new Aston Villa manager.
Manager or director of football?
Well, I think manager or coach. Is he going to be director of football?
Well, no, previously there was this story at the end of last week. It was because of his dodgy ticker and all that. And the fact that they think that Kevin McDonald's done a decent job, that they might keep him on as a kind of more hands-on fellow with Gerard upstairs. But it's just that he's come from this job as technical director of the French Federation. Obviously, he didn't do a very bang-up job there. Equally, last time he was in charge of anything remotely resembling player acquisitions with Liverpool... I suppose he was at Lyon as well.
Yeah, he's done pretty well at Lyon. I mean, they won the league twice. I think Villa would be very happy to have him as a manager, or should be. He's a manager of greater standing in the game than Martin O'Neill. I mean, he's won a lot of league titles, won six trophies at Liverpool.
Do you think he has a greater standing in the game than Martin O'Neill?
Well, he does seem to be one of those football characters that are talked about in a very different way by people within the game than by fans. Fans, certainly in England, don't give him a great deal of respect. Towards the end of his time at Liverpool, and in fact for most of his time at Liverpool, he wasn't that great. But he's seen as one of the great tactical minds. He's always on FIFA think tanks and UEFA.
With Andy Roxburgh.
Yeah, let's just point out that he punk and pile that report that said that Wayne Rooney was one of the stars of the World Cup.
Yeah. Well, anyway, there you go. It's going to be interesting. So you reckon this is all going to go through, and by what, Tuesday?
Well, there's supposed to be some sort of announcement today. I'm no doubt their eyes are goggling with excitement.
Aren't there a whole batch of players like Brad Friedel who were at Liverpool under Houllier who are less than keen?
Warnock as well, yeah.
Oh, right. And they went and complained to whoever they complained at.
I never totally trust English players complaining about foreign managers. Yeah. I mean, you smell something wrong. Wasn't the problem with Christian Gross that they weren't allowed to wear flip-flops in the shower? They get bogged down in ridiculous kind of cultural differences. I would only trust that stuff so far.
Mm.
I was very fortunate at the end of the World Cup that's just passed to spend a little bit of time out in Johannesburg, and I was in this mall in Sandton where I was walking past a tiny ice cream parlour which had this massive sign on the outside of it saying, "Such and such ice cream parlour welcomes Gerard Houllier." And it was just a really bizarre thing. It's just come into my mind just now. And I was thinking, has Gerard Houllier come all the way to Africa to see this one tiny ice cream parlour? Is this something that he'd heard about from back home? Sorry, it's completely irrelevant.
The point is that one should always welcome Gerard Houllier, and that Aston Villa fans should bear that in mind.
Well, that's it, yeah.
And that they might give him ice cream.
Hmm. All right, well, with Aston Villa in the shape they're in, with the players they've got, what's the best he could achieve? What would be a successful reign for him?
Get into the Champions League. He's managed in the Champions League before. That's what he should be aiming for.
Hmm?
That is what he should be aiming for. It would be extremely, extremely impressive if he were to achieve
it. I'm not saying it's going to happen.
Simon, you were saying before, you think that they will get him, and you think within a month or two they'll all be feeling miserable about it.
Well, I think that a new manager is appointed, that you should normally embrace the decision and go with him. But I watched Liverpool when he was the Liverpool manager, and he didn't inspire me particularly at that time.
Oh, dear. Portugal. What about them, then? A 4-4 against Cyprus at home, Guimarães. And, well, they've got all sorts of problems, haven't they?
Much more worrying, really, than France, I think, Portugal.
Yeah.
France have a list of excuses as long as their injury list, which is very, very long indeed. Portugal had... they had no Cristiano Ronaldo, but they had a decent team out, and they just played, they particularly defended, very poorly indeed, at home to Cyprus. And I think it's not very promising for them.
They had a whole lot of players who retired, though. Deco, of course, Simão, though, and Ferreira, Paulo Ferreira as well. Mm. So, and with Ronaldo out, and of course Queiroz, who's, is it a six-month ban he's got for insulting a doping official? Not sure what actually happened there. Probably he was taking the... No, okay. Which of them was taking the... Yeah. Sorry, Sam.
I think the worst of the criticism from Friday's result was aimed at their two centre-backs, Bruno Alves and Ricardo Carvalho, who shouldn't have any excuses. They should, as a pairing, they've got the experience and the ability to stop Cyprus from scoring four.
Hmm. Well, next up, they're in Oslo against Norway, so it'll be interesting to see what happens on that. On Tuesday night, Republic of Ireland, despite the best efforts of Robbie Keane, they get a victory. Well done to them against Armenia. Well, hey, Keith Fahey.
Yeah, it's a great story, isn't it? It's nice. You know, his player has been a bit troubled in his time. Was a trainee at Arsenal, drifted out of the game a bit. He's come back. He's done very well with Birmingham. Actually, he was pretty useful last season, and it's a really good story for him, scoring a winner on his debut.
Mm, fantastic stuff. Northern Ireland, a 1-0 win in Slovenia. Excellent stuff. In their group, Italy, with a 2-1 win in Estonia. Wasn't greeted with the most rapturous of reception, this, by the Italian press, but I thought it was a very good result, Paolo.
It's a perfectly good result, although, you know, again, Estonia are 94th in the world rankings. It's not something to get too overexcited about. The performance wasn't massively impressive. There was a point they were losing 1-0 where you thought... they could actually lose this game, and that really will be a disaster, because they've actually gone previously 7 games without a win, and this would have been the 8th, which would have equaled the record for Italy of games without a win. So it was a win. That was important. Cassano scored. Cassano. He also set up the other with a fantastic little flick of the heel, which nutmegged the defender. But at the same time, he actually wasn't particularly impressive for good parts of the game. So there were sort of positives and negatives to be taken from it, but ultimately they'll just be happy to have started the campaign with a win, and next up they've got the Faroe Islands, so that should be 2 wins.
Right, OK. Holland had a 5-0 win over San Marino. It's a hat-trick for Klaas-Jan Huntelaar. Germany won in Belgium with Miroslav Klose's goal. It was a big game, that, we were saying, for all the Germans. That's his 53rd in 102 international matches. Well done, Miroslav. Very good. Now, he said, having lost his way. Let's just look at one or two posts. Zonal Marking says, can you ask Paolo about the Italian goalkeeper situation? Surely Viviano is the answer in Buffon's absence. Paolo.
It's a really interesting situation at the moment, because Buffon's out and Marchetti's out. And so you've got these two young
Marchetti's
keepers.
Out because he's been frozen out by his club. It's bizarre, this, no?
Yeah. To be honest with you, I personally wouldn't have started him ahead of either of these two anyway. Yeah. So for me, from the Italy angle, it's yes, but it is a slightly odd situation.
The other two being Viviani and Sirigu. Yeah,
Emiliano Viviano and Salvatore Sirigu, who are the two keepers. Viviano plays for Bologna and Sirigu...
held into goalless with a brilliant performance at the weekend. Sorry, Paolo.
Sirigu plays for Palermo, and both of them are actually really promising young keepers, which is much needed, because there's sort of been a gap in Italy after Buffon where there haven't been many great keepers coming into it. You know, Sirigu played against Estonia and he ended up making a bit of a, I don't know if I quite call it a howler. He certainly dropped the ball for the first goal. It had been a long shot and he sort of fumbled it into the path of the striker who jabbed it home. Funnily enough, if you'd asked me before the game, I would have said Sirigu is the one who was less prone to blunders, less likely equally to have a blinding game, whereas Viviano is perhaps the one who you think you see him have these fantastic games, but then you also see him make big mistakes. This game, of course, is being played in Florence, and Florentines are not...
The next one
coming up against Faroe Islands. And Florence is traditionally not a very comfortable place for Italy to play. So the last 10-20 years, they've been quite hostile, the crowds, towards the national team. And Viviano is from Florence. He named his first daughter Viola, which is a nickname of Fiorentina, so he would be a popular choice, and there's possibly some element of that coming into it. There was also some discussion that because you had these two young promising keepers, Prandelli, it has been suggested by some reporters, was already planning to play one of them in the first game and one of them in the second game. The only problem now is, if he does that, it looks like he's dropping Sirigu for the mistake against Estonia, and I think he doesn't necessarily want to create that impression.
Apparently so.
Brilliant. Rudy can't fail, so I'd like to know the pod's opinion on the gross mismatches that European qualifiers throw up. Spain, Liechtenstein for one. I personally feel that minnows like Andorra, Faroe Islands, San Marino, Malta, Luxembourg, England, etc. Oh, sorry, that's my mistake. Should have groups of their own, and the winner gets a go with the medium and heavyweights. Thoughts? Basically, what he's saying is, let's have divisions.
I don't necessarily agree with that.
No?
Well, I think there's possibly... For there are very four or five teams, but I wouldn't go beyond that.
I think the European Championships are about to be expanded after the 2012, and once that comes in, the whole of qualifying is going to be a little bit even more of a sham than it is now, in that all the top teams should very easily qualify, and it inevitably raises questions about the format of qualifying, and I think it probably does need to be looked at.
Do you think there's a case, I was just thinking this earlier today, if you're going to do that, to do something like the Rugby World Cup do, where a certain number of teams are seeded in so that they don't have to go through this gargantuan qualifying and then other teams have to play their way in?
I don't think it's the same. In rugby, you don't get upsets. The best team, you know, a more powerful team will always win, but that's not necessarily the case in football. It's funny, you don't really see smaller nations becoming much better anymore in the way you did in the 80s and even in the 90s, maybe.
Cyprus.
Teams like Denmark.
Cyprus.
Cyprus on a surge.
Yeah, the last 4 or 5 years, they keep coming up with brilliant results. You had that Anorthosis.
They still haven't qualified for a...
Famagusta in the Champions League.
You might get club
upsets.
Teams who have a lot of money.
And the national team as well. They caused Italy problems in qualifying, didn't they? And they're causing
problems. Hopefully that will happen. Hopefully they'll qualify for a tournament. But you just don't... It has reached a kind of stasis now. You don't see smaller nations suddenly becoming...
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. We've reached a bit of a plateau with it.
The other thing is are you talking specifically about Europe? Because obviously Paraguay and Uruguay both sort of overachieved it.
Oh, no. Yeah, talking about Europe specifically.
But then if you were to... allow big teams to qualify automatically, they might consider it actually a hindrance to not get competitive games.
I think that'd be an awful idea. You can't possibly do that.
Well, there you go. Now, that's it for part two. Very, very shortly, we'll be turning our attention to Scotland. Right, Scotland then, and also, Barney, producer Ben wants to know about John Cena, the WWE... wrestler, is he?
Yeah, well, I interviewed him the other day. I didn't really know who he was, but I understood from the way it took me 3 or 4 levels of people to get close to him, and people kept saying, "You're going to be on with John Cena in 10 minutes.
Right.
That he was actually a very famous person, and afterwards I later discovered he was very famous. He was very nice, actually. He also described, he's very open about wrestling, he described it as, we film it in a kind of, as though it's a live sporting event, he said.
Yeah.
Yeah, which was, I thought, refreshingly candid.
Yes.
And I watched his film as well, Legendary, and it was surprisingly good. I meant to just fast forward through to the fighty bits, but I ended up watching the whole thing.
What is it, a kind of fly-on-the-wall documentary?
No, it's a strangely...
title to Surprisingly Good.
Yeah, Surprisingly Good would be a good title. It's
better than Legendary.
It's the strangely overlooked genre of this small-town family wrestling drama.
Right. Films about grappling, what do you think? You like films about wrestling?
Well, this film was about wrestling in terms of the Greco-Roman wrestling. So it was just people lying on top of each other, writhing. And, like, it wasn't really very cinematic, but they did their best.
Oh, so it wasn't about the kind of WWE
thing. You may find
it
a niche following. No, it was more about how wrestling gets inside you and it tears you up. It's an addiction.
Hmm.
Your father wrestled before you and it destroyed him.
Oh.
It was that sort of thing.
Right.
It was very good, though. Legendary with John Cena.
Have you not spoiled the ending?
I've always wondered why there's never been a good film about Greco-Roman wrestling.
Well, there is, finally. And it's,
thank God
it's
for that.
If you come to my local specialty store, you'll find plenty.
Yeah.
Anyway, now, back to the football. Spain, woof, those world champions. 4-0 against mighty Liechtenstein. Some cracking goals as well. Torres got a brace. David Villa got a nice goal, just for a change. And also, so did David Silva. In the same group, the Czech Republic, who didn't play, and Scotland, who did, and only managed a 0-0 away to Lithuania. I say only managed, perhaps in the current context of Scottish football, is that actually a good point for the Scottish under Craig Levein? Let's dial up our long-suffering Scottish correspondent, Ewan Murray, and hear what he thinks.
Am I long-suffering because I work for The Guardian and because of the football I have to watch every week?
Your choice, Ewan, your choice.
Both.
Both. Well, here was my point. Was it a good result for Scotland on Friday in Lithuania?
I don't think it was a good result in terms of the context of trying to qualify for European Championships. But if you take it as I think we have to now, that we're a second-rate, at best, football nation, then a point and a clean sheet away from home against a team who are probably of a similar standard to what Scotland are now, is not a bad result at all.
So you would say Lithuania more or less at the same standard that Scotland have got?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what the evidence suggests. I mean, Scotland have now been to Lithuania four times pretty recently as well, actually, and only won once. I think they're ranked 11 places below Scotland in the FIFA rankings. So there's not the difference that, you know, we can't afford to look back at the 70s and the 80s and the 90s to a lesser extent and say that Scotland should beat these countries, because that is not the case anymore.
Wait, what's the biggest problem, Ewan? Is it scoring goals, or is there something deeper than that?
Well, there's a deeper and you know, widely versed issue regarding the standard of players that Scotland is bringing through. At international level, I mean, you said it, we don't score enough goals. Kenny Miller has been our main striker of the international team, hasn't scored in 12 games for Scotland. And, you know, the first job of Craig Levein, as is his style, is going to make Scotland hard to beat. But the next thing is, it has to be coming out and scoring goals, and we haven't mastered that in the last three campaigns, really.
Right. Next up, it's Liechtenstein. That's at home, yes?
Yeah, I mean, it should be a bit of a no-win situation, a non-event for Craig Levein tomorrow night. Scotland should beat Liechtenstein quite comfortably. The debate, of course, is whether Levein sticks with his own principles and sticks with tradition and plays, you know, a side that's dominated by midfield, or whether he bites the bullet, brings back Chris Boyd into attack, and goes 4-4-2 and goes for it. James McFadden also was left out in Lithuania. Whether he comes back, as I suspect he will, or whether Levein, as I say, sticks by his principles and goes for a more pragmatic approach.
What's the reaction been in the Scottish press to Levein and his first games?
Well, Levein is well respected up here. He did a very good job at club level at Hearts and then at Dundee United. It's safe to say he's had an easier ride than George Burley did. But, I mean, Levein is straight talking. He's made no secret about the fact that, as I said, he will make us hard to beat first and then take things slowly from there. The interesting thing has been the contrast. I mean, some papers, and I did it, you know, from the game on Friday night, regarded that as a bad result, as I said, in the context of qualification. Others regarded it as a good result and regarded it as progress, because we've had such traumatic times in away games recently, you know, losing heavily to Norway, Sweden, Wales, that it could be seen as improvement.
Mm. It's not so, just the national team as well. They've been handed their bottoms on various away trips recently. The clubs in the Europa League, Celtic, absolutely, dumped 4-0?
4-0 in Utrecht. I mean, a team who finished seventh in the Dutch league. I mean, that comes back to what I was saying about our general standing.
What's happened? I mean, Ewan, I know it's a massive thing, but why is it that the Scottish football has reached this? Is it an idea? We shall see. This extremely negative position.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it. I mean, it's not a surprise. And it's not been sudden. I mean, the point of certain people, Malta Smith will make this point, is that only 2 years ago, Rangers were in the UEFA Cup final, and Celtic at that point had qualified for the last 16 of the Champions League 2 years in a row. So we have to be slightly careful about painting it as completely doom and gloom. I don't think we're rank rotten, and we're certainly not the best of the best. But at the minute, we have a problem both at club level and international level competing with, you know, slightly better than mediocre foreign opposition. And that's what, in the short term, needs to be solved, because we now have a generation of kids. It's 12 years since Scotland competed in a major tournament. You have a generation of children who haven't been used to Scotland playing in finals at all. And that is damaging for the game on a wider scale.
Hmm. All right, Ewan. Well, listen, we hope for better in the match against Liechtenstein on Tuesday, and look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thanks very much. Speak soon.
Thanks, Ewan.
Can I say something about Liechtenstein?
Yeah.
As an interesting fact, you can hire the whole of Liechtenstein for a party if you've got enough money. It's like a football equivalent of a youth club.
Do you get just the country, or do you get the people?
You hire the whole country.
The people?
I think the people.
Where, Barney? Where did you discover this?
When England played them last time, it was one of the interesting facts we dug up.
You can hire Liechtenstein the country for a party.
Yeah, because all the sort of big, nice bits of it are kind of centrally owned, and you just basically hire the country. I think it costs something like £50,000 for a night. It's surprisingly cheap.
You can hire Liechtenstein for a night for £50,000.
Maybe it's more than that, but you can definitely hire Liechtenstein. Seems they rent it out.
Okay, well, that certainly raised the mood after that vain opening chat with the UN. That's magnificent. You could do what you wanted within the confines
Simon
of Liechtenstein.
Could have had his three-year-old daughter's birthday party in Liechtenstein.
And could I have asked them all to dress up as Peppa Pig?
I don't know what you can make
I bet
them
you
do.
Could. I don't see why not. You're hiring the place. You are the customer.
It's mine.
Yeah.
It's yours.
It's mine, dressed like a pig.
You could dress up as Dr. Doom and reenact, I don't know, erect stakes on every... Yeah, the imagination races. No doubt listeners will wish to post in what they would do with Liechtenstein for a night. But that's it for today's pod. Many, many thanks for battling through it with us.
Non-league day. I spent an entire morning...
Simon, I'm so sorry. Yes. Yes, non-league day. Yeah. You wrote a lovely piece ahead of non-league day, which regular listeners will know, was the special initiative to get more people to attend their local non-league clubs on a weekend which didn't see any Premier League or division or championship action. And was it a big success?
Well, I did spend my... a good chunk of my morning hunched over my calculator trying to working out whether it had been a success or a failure by comparing Saturday's attendances with each club's average attendance over the season so far, and statistically I discovered it hadn't been much cop.
Is it the ticket prices?
Well, lots of teams reduce ticket prices, especially for Saturday,
right,
with the aim of attracting season ticket holders for top two divisions, clubs in the top two divisions. Ticket prices are higher than you'd expect, and I find that there's often not much difference between Championship ticket prices and Blue Square Premier ticket prices, even though there's a big gulf in quality. And that's clearly something that does put people off going to non-league football. But people who do spend a lot of time going to non-league football will talk about the quality of experience in so many ways being richer there than in the top two divisions. But I'm slightly disheartened and that it wasn't more of a success than it appears to have been. Looking at the attendances in the top three divisions in of the non-league pyramid, which is the Blue Square Premier in the North and South, more clubs' attendances were down on average than were up, and with a few quite decent numbers, and only a couple of big winners. Ilkeston Town up by 272, and they only got to see a 0-0 draw against Eastwood Town. bit disappointing. But yeah, overall, I calculated the aggregate supporter loss in those top three divisions at 284 people. So across the board, attendance is down on Saturday.
Well, it's better than in Italy, Paolo, where they're all going bankrupt, aren't they?
Yeah, there's some quite horrifying numbers when you look at them. First off, for the lower divisions, the amount of teams that have gone bankrupt recently. I think you may have them in front of you, I'm not sure.
Oh, well, thanks. Slasher actually posted these in. We had three teams, I would say, from slightly higher divisions than the equivalent of the Blue Square, but from Division 2, second tier, you had three teams who've been declared bankrupt and relegated down to the amateur game. Liga Pro Prima Divisione, which is Division 3, or third tier, seven teams.
I think the obvious thing is we are having a global economic crisis, as everyone hears, and it's true that Italian clubs, as a rule, own less equity than English clubs. So the fact that they have less to fall back on in hard times is a problem.
You mean they don't have stadiums?
Exactly. Especially not, you know, the smaller clubs get, the more likely the stadium is to be owned communally. Then there's also the fact that this year Serie A has separated from the lower divisions and is now looking after its own TV rights. So there's all sorts of little things that go towards it and why this year particularly has been bad, although it's not the first year when we've had quite a few lower league teams going bankrupt.
Well, there you go. That's Football Weekly then. We'll be back on Thursday with a roundup of all the Tuesday action and a look forward to the return of club football on the weekend. Many thanks to Ben on production duties, Barney Rone, Paolo Bandini and Simon Burnton, and you, the listener. Hope you have a terrific week, and we'll speak to you in a couple of days.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.